in Michael's expression. It is not for me to judge his soul, no matter how much I might want to. Hell's bells, I muttered. No wonder Nicodemus has killed so many knights, if you're all as idiotic as this. Harry, Michael began. I interrupted him. Look at him, Michael. He isn't a victim. He's a freaking collaborator. That poor bastard Rasmussen might have been dragooned into working with the Denarians, but Cassius does it because he wants to do it.
There's no way for you to be sure of that, Harry, Sonya said.
Why are you giving him a fair chance? Which of them has ever turned away from their coins?
Sonya put his dark hand on my shoulder and said, I did. I looked back at him, frowning.
I was of their number, Sonya said. I was less experienced, foolish, proud. I did not set out to be a monster, but that much power corrupts. Shiro faced the fallen I had allowed in. He exposed its lies, and I made a better choice.
Traitor, said Cassius, his voice cold. We handed you the world, power, glory, everything you could have wanted.
Sonya faced the man and said,
What I wanted, you could never give me. I had to find it for myself.
He extended a hand.
Cassius, you can leave them just as I did. Help us, please, and let us help you.
Cassius leaned back as though Sonya's hand might burn him and hissed,
I will eat your eyes.
We can't leave him here, I said. He'll shoot us in the back. He'll try to kill us.
Maybe, Michael said quietly and didn't move. I wanted to be angry with Sonya and Michael, but I couldn't. I'm only human. I'd flirted with dark powers before, made stupid deals, bad choices. I'd been given a chance to work free of them, or I'd have been dead long ago. I understood what Michael and Sonya were saying and doing. I understood why. I didn't like it, but I couldn't really gainsay it without making a hypocrite of myself. There, but for the lack of a demon-infested coin, went I.
Cassius started wheezing and laughing his dry, contemptuous laugh.
Run along, he said. Run along. I'll think over your words, re-examine my life, walk the straight and narrow.
Let's go, Michael said quietly.
We can't leave him, I insisted.
The police aren't going to have anything on him, Harry. We're not going to kill him. We're finished here. Have faith. We'll find an answer somehow.
Cassius laughed at Michael's back as he walked out. Sonya followed him, lingering to look back over his shoulder at me.
Fools, Cassius murmured, rising. Weak fools.
I picked up the bat again and turned to the door. You're wrong, I said to Cassius.
Weak, Cassius repeated. The old man was screaming after only an hour, you know.
Nicodemus started with his back, lashed him with chains. Then Deirdre played with him.
I gave Cassius a hard look over my shoulder. He was sneering, lip lifted from his teeth.
Deirdre likes to break fingers and toes. I wish I'd been able to stay longer. I only got to pull out his toenails.
His smile widened, eyes gleaming.
The woman, the fellowship woman, she is yours.
I felt my lip lift away from my teeth. Cassius's eyes gleamed.
She bled prettily, didn't she? The next time I catch her, you won't be there to disrupt my conjuration. I'll let the snakes eat her, bite by bite.
I stared at him. Cassius smiled again.
But there is mercy for me, is there not? Forgiveness, indeed. God is great.
I turned away from him again and said very quietly, People like you always mistake compassion for weakness. Michael and Sonya aren't weak. Fortunately for you, they're good men.
Cassius laughed at me. Unfortunately for you, I'm not.
I spun around, swinging the bat as hard as I could, and broke Cassius's right kneecap. He screamed in shock and sudden surprise and went down. Odd, crackling sounds came from the joint. I swung again and broke his right ankle. Cassius screamed. I broke his left knee for him, too, and his left ankle. He was thrashing around and screaming a lot, so it took me maybe a dozen swings.
Stop!
He managed to gasp.
Stop! Stop! Stop!
I kicked him in the mouth to shut him up, stomped his right forearm to the floor, and crushed his hand with another half dozen swings. I pinned his left arm down the same way and put the bat on my shoulder.
Listen to me, you worthless piece of shit. You aren't a victim. You chose to be one of them. You've been serving dark forces your whole life. Freddie Mercury would say Beelzebub has a devil put aside for you.
What do you think you're doing?
He gasped.
You can't. You won't.
I leaned down and twisted his false priest's collar, half choking him.
The knights are good men. I'm not. And I won't lose a second sleep over killing you.
I shook him with each word, hard enough to rattle his bloodied teeth.
Where is Nicodemus?
Cassius broke, sobbing. His bladder had let go at some point, and the room smelled like urine. He choked and spat out blood and a broken tooth.
I'll tell,
he gasped.
Please don't.
I let his collar go and straightened.
Where?
I don't know,
he said, cowering away from my eyes.
He didn't tell me. Meeting him tonight. Was going to meet him tonight. 8.
Meet him where?
Airport.
Cassius said. He started throwing up. I kept his arm pinned, so it mostly went all over himself.
I don't know exactly where.
What is he doing?
The curse. He's going to unleash the curse. Use the shroud. The old man's blood. He has to be moving when he completes the ritual.
Why?
Curse is a contagion. He has to spread it as far as he can. More exposure to it. Make himself stronger. Apocalypse.
I took my foot off of his arm and smashed the motel's phone to pieces with the bat. I found his cell phone and crushed it too. Then I reached into my pocket and dropped a quarter on the floor near him. There's a payphone on the other side of the parking lot past a patch of broken glass. You'd better get yourself an ambulance. I turned and walked to the door without looking back. If I see you again, ever, I'll kill you. Michael and Sonya waited for me outside the door. Sonya's face held a certain amount of satisfaction. Michael's expression was grave, worried, his eyes on mine. It had to be done, I said to Michael. My voice sounded cold. He's alive. It's more than he deserves.
Perhaps, Michael said. But what you did, Harry, it was wrong.
A part of me felt sick. Another part felt satisfied. I wasn't sure which one of them was bigger. You heard what he said about Shiro, about Susan. Michael's eyes darkened, and he nodded.
It doesn't make it right.
No, it doesn't, I met his eyes. Think God'll forgive me? Michael was quiet for a moment. And then his expression softened. He clasped my shoulder and said,
God is always merciful.
What you did for him was actually quite generous, Sonya said philosophically. Relatively speaking, he might be hurt, but he is, after all, alive. He'll have a nice long while to reconsider his choices.
Uh-huh, I said. I'm a giver. Did it for his own good.
Sonya nodded gravely.
Good intentions.
Michael nodded.
Who are we to judge you?
His eyes flashed, and he asked Sonya,
Did you see the snake's face right when Harry turned with the bat?
Sonya smiled and started whistling as we walked through the parking lot. We piled into the truck.
Drop me off at my place, I said. I need to pick up a couple things, make some phone calls.
The duel? Michael said. Harry, are you sure you don't want me to?
Leave it to me, I said. You've already got something on your plate. I can handle things. I'll meet you at the airport afterward and help you find Shiro.
If you live, Sonya said. Yes, thank you, Comrade Obvious.
The Russian grinned.
Was that a quarter you gave Kashev?
Yeah.
For the phone?
Yeah.
Michael noted. Phone calls cost more than that now.
I slouched back and allowed myself a small smile.
Yeah, I know.
Sonya and Michael burst out laughing. Michael pounded on the steering wheel. I didn't join them, but I enjoyed their laughter while I could. The February sun was already sinking fast toward the horizon.
Chapter 29. Back at my apartment, I called Murphy on her personal cell phone. I used simple sentences and told her everything.
Dear God, Murphy said.
Can I summarize or what?
They can infect the city with this curse thing?
Looks like, I said.
How can I help?
We've got to keep them from getting it into the air. They won't be on public transportation. Find out if any chartered planes are taking off between 7 and 8:30. Helicopters, too.
Hang on, Murphy said. I heard computer keys clicking.
Murphy saying something to someone, a police radio. A moment later, she said, voice tense.
There's trouble.
Yeah?
There are a pair of detectives heading out to arrest you. Looks like homicide wants you for questioning. There's no warrant listed.
Crap. I took a deep breath.
Rudolph? Brown-nosing rat, Murphy muttered.
Harry, they're almost to your place. You've only got a few minutes.
Can you decoy them? Get some manpower to the airport?
I don't know, Murphy said. I'm supposed to be a mile from this case, and it isn't as though I can announce the terrorists are about to use a biological weapon on the city.
Use Rudolph, I said. Tell him off the record that I said the Shroud is leaving town on a chartered flight from the airport. Let him take the heat for it if they don't find anything.
Murphy let out a harsh little laugh. There are times when you can be a clever man, Harry. It takes me by surprise.
Why, thank you.
What else can I do?
I told her.
You're kidding.
No, we may need the manpower, and SI's out of this one.
Just when I had hope for your intelligence, too.
You'll do it?
Yeah, can't promise anything, but I'll do it.
Get moving, they're less than 5 minutes away.
Gone. Thank you, Murph.
I hung up the phone, opened my closet, and dug into a couple of old cardboard boxes I kept at the back until I found my old canvas duster. It was battered and torn in a couple of places, but it was clean. It didn't have the same reassuring weight as the leather duster, but it did more to hide my gun than my jacket. And it made me look cool. Well, maybe cooler, anyway. I grabbed my things, locked up my place behind me, and got into Martin's rental car. Martin wasn't in it. Susan sat behind the wheel.
Hurry, I said. She nodded and pulled out.
A few minutes later, no one had pulled us over.
I take it Martin isn't helping.
Susan shook her head.
No. He said he had other duties that took precedence. He said that I did, too.
What'd you say?
That he was a narrow-minded, hidebound, anachronistic, egotistical bastard.
No wonder he likes you.
Susan smiled a little and said,
The fellowship is his life. He serves a cause.
What is it to you? I asked.
Susan remained silent for a long time as we drove across town.
How did it go?
We caught the imposter. He told us where the bad guys would be later tonight.
What did you do with him?
I told her. She looked at me for a while and then said,
Are you all right?
Fine.
You don't look fine.
It's done.
But are you all right?
I shrugged. I don't know. I'm glad you didn't see it.
Susan asked,
Oh? Why?
You're a girl. Beating up bad guys is a boy thing.
Chauvinist pig, Susan said.
Yeah, I get it from Murphy. She's a bad influence.
We hit the first traffic sign directing us toward the stadium, and Susan asked,
Do you really think you can win?
Yeah. Hell, Ortega is only the third or fourth most disturbing thing I've tangled with today.
But even if you do win, what does it change?
Me getting killed now?
That way I get to be killed later tonight instead.
Susan laughed. There was nothing happy in it.
You don't deserve a life like this.
I squinted my eyes and made my voice gravelly.
Deserves got nothing.
So help me, God, if you quote Clint Eastwood at me, I'm wrapping this car around a telephone pole.
Do you feel lucky, punk?
I smiled and turned my left hand palm up. I felt her hand settle lightly on mine a moment later, and she said, "A girl's gotta draw the line somewhere." We rode the rest of the way to the stadium in silence, holding hands. I had never been to Wrigley when it was empty. That wasn't really the point of the stadium. You went there to be among about a bajillion people and see something happen. This time, with acres and acres of unoccupied asphalt, the stadium at its center looked huge, and somehow more skeletal than when it was filled with vehicles and cheering thousands. The wind sighed through the stadium, gusting, whistling, and moaning. Twilight had fallen, and the unlit street lamps cast spidery shadows over the lots. Darkness gaped in the arches and doorways of the stadium, empty as the eyes of a skull.
"Thank God that it isn't too creepy or anything," I muttered.
"What now?" Susan asked. Another car pulled in behind us. I recognized it from McAnally's the night before. The car pulled up maybe 50 feet away and rolled to a stop. Ortega got out and leaned down to say something to the driver, a man with a dark complexion and amber-toned glasses. There were two more men in the back seat, though I couldn't see much of them. I was betting they were all Red Court. "Let's not look scared," I said, and got out of the car. I didn't look at Ortega, but drew out my staff with me, planted it on the ground, and stared at the stadium. The wind caught my coat and blew it back enough to show the gun on my hip now and again. I traded in my sweats for dark jeans and a black silk shirt. The Mongols, or somebody, wore silk shirts because they would catch arrows as they entered wounds and enable them to pull barbed arrowheads out without ripping their innards apart. I wasn't planning on getting shot with barbed arrows, but weirder things have happened. Susan got out and walked up to stand beside me. She stared at the stadium, too, and the wind blew her hair back the same way it did my coat.
"Very nice," she murmured, hardly moving her mouth. "That's a good look on you. Ortega's driver is about to wet his pants."
"You say the nicest things to me."
We just stood there for a couple of minutes until I heard a deep, rhythmic rumbling, one of those annoying loud bass stereos in some moron's car. The rumbling got louder, then there was a squealing of tires taking a tight turn, and Thomas pulled into the lot in a different white sports car than I'd seen him in the night before. The music got louder as he sped across the lot and parked his car diagonally across the lines I'd unconsciously respected when I'd parked. He killed the stereo and got out, a small cloud of smoke emerging with him. It wasn't cigarette smoke.
"Paolo!" Thomas caroled.
He wore tight blue jeans and a black T-shirt with a Buffy the Vampire Slayer logo. The laces to one of his combat boots were untied, and he carried a bottle of scotch in his hand. He pulled from it cheerfully and wove a drunken line to Ortega. Thomas offered out the bottle, his balance wobbling.
"Have a swig?"
Ortega slapped the bottle from Thomas's hand. It shattered on the ground.
"Spoil sport?" Thomas slurred, wavering. "Hola, Harry! Hola, Susan!"
He waved at us and all but fell down.
"I was going to offer you some, too, but that plan's been blown all to hell now."
"Maybe another time," Susan said. A blue light appeared in one of the tunnels from the stadium. A moment later, a vehicle somewhere between a compact car and a golf cart rolled into the parking lot, a whirling blue bubble light flashing on its roof. With the quiet hum of electric motors, it zipped over to us and stopped. Kincaid sat behind the steering wheel and nodded to the rear of the vehicle. "In. We're set up inside." We walked over to the security cart. Ortega started to get on, but I held up my hand to him. "Ladies first," I said quietly, and gave Susan my hand as she got on. I followed her. Ortega and Thomas followed. Thomas had put on a pair of headphones and was bobbing his chin in a vague fashion that was probably supposed to be in rhythm. Kincaid started up the cart and called over his shoulder.
"Where's the old man?"
"Gone," I said. I jerked a thumb at Susan. "Had to go to the bench." Kincaid looked from me to Susan and shrugged.
"Nice bench."
He drove us through several passages in the stadium, somehow finding his way despite the fact that no lights were on, and I could barely see. Eventually, we rolled out onto the field from one of the bullpens.
The stadium was dark, but for where three spotlights basted the pitcher's mound and first and third base in pools of light. Kincaid drove to the pitcher's mound, stopped, and said, "Everyone out." We did. Kincaid parked the cart over home plate, then padded through the shadows to the visiting team's dugout. "They're here," he said quietly. The archive emerged from the dugout, carrying a small, carved wooden box before her. She wore a dark dress with no frills or ruffles, and a gray cape held closed with a silver brooch. She was still little, still adorable, but something in her bearing left no illusions about the difference in her apparent age and her knowledge and capability. She walked to the pitcher's mound, not looking at anyone, her focus on the box she carried. She set it down very carefully, and then lifted the lid from the top of the box and stepped back. A wave of nauseating cold flooded out when she opened the box. It went past me, through me. I was the only one there to react to it. Susan put her hand on my arm, kept her eyes on Ortega and Thomas, and asked, "Harry?" My last meal had been a drive-through taco on the way back from the meeting with Cassius, but it was trying to leave. I kept it down and forced the sickening cold away from me with an effort of will. The sensation lessened. "Fine," I said. "I'm fine." The archive looked up at me, child features solemn.
"You know what's inside the box?"
"I think so. I've never actually seen it."
"Seen what?"
Thomas asked. Instead of answering, the archive drew a small box out of her pocket. She opened the box and delicately plucked out an insect as long as her own fingers, a brown scorpion by its tail. She looked around to make sure she had everyone's attention. She did. Then she dropped the scorpion into the box. There was an instant, immediate sound, somewhere between a wildcat scream and the sizzle of bacon hitting a hot skillet. Something that looked vaguely like a cloud of ink in clear water floated up out of the box. It was about the size of a baby's head. Dozens of shadowy tendrils held the scorpion, drawing it up into the air along with the inky cloud. Dark violet flickers of flame played over the insect's shell for all of 2 or 3 seconds, and then it simply crumbled, carapace falling away in flakes and dust. The cloudy mass rose up to a height of about 5 feet before the archive murmured a word. It stopped in place, bobbing gently, holding there.
"Damn,"
Thomas said. He took the earphones out. Music with many electric guitars sounded tinnily from them.
"And this is what?"
"Mordite," I said quietly. "Deathstone."
"Yes,"
the archive said. Ortega drew in a slow breath and nodded in understanding.
"Deathstone, huh?" Thomas said. "It sort of looks like someone spray-painted a soap bubble and gave it tentacles."
"It isn't a soap bubble," I said. "There's a solid piece inside. The energies it carries in it are what create that shroud effect around it." Thomas poked a finger at it.
"What does it do?"
I caught his wrist before he could touch it and pushed his hand away. "It kills, hence the name Deathstone, you half-wit."
"Oh," Thomas said, nodding with drunken sagacity. "It looked cool when it gacked that little thing, but so what? It's a bug zapper."
"If you disrespect this thing, it's going to get you killed," I said. "It would kill anything living, exactly the same way. Anything. It's not from our world."
"It's extraterrestrial?" asked Susan.
"You do not understand, Miss Rodriguez," Ortega said quietly. "Mordite is not from this galaxy or this universe. It is not of our reality."
I had reservations about Ortega's presence on the home team roster, but I nodded. "It's from outside. It's congealed anti-life. A chip of this stuff makes nuclear waste look like secondhand smoke. Being near it draws the life off you, bit by bit. If you touch it, it kills you. Period."
"Precisely,"
said the archive. She stepped forward to look at both Ortega and me.
"An enchantment binds the particle in place. It is also sensitive to applied will. The duelists will face each other, the Mordite between them. Will it toward your opponent? He, with the greatest force of will, controls the Mordite. The duel will end when it has devoured one of you."
Gulp. The archive continued.
Seconds will observe from first and third bases facing their duelist's opponent. Mr. Kincaid will ensure that no undue interference is perpetrated by either second. I have instructed him to do so with extreme prejudice.
Thomas wobbled a little and eyed the archive. Huh? The girl faced him and said,
He'll kill you if you interfere.
Oh, Thomas said cheerfully. Gotcha, pumpkin. Ortega glared at Thomas and made a disgusted sound. Thomas found something else to look at and backed a prudent step away.
I will monitor both duelists to ensure that no energies are employed on their behalf. I, too, will resolve any infractions with extreme prejudice. Do you understand?
Ortega nodded. I said, Yeah.
Are there any questions, gentlemen?
The archive asked. I shook my head. Ortega did, too.
Each of you may make a brief statement,
said the archive. Ortega drew a band of black and silver beads from his pocket. Without making an effort, I could feel the defensive energies bound up within them. He regarded me with casual mistrust as he bound the bracelet to his left side and said, This can end in only one way. In answer, I fished one of the anti-venom potions from my pocket, popped the top, and slugged it down. I burped and said, Excuse me?
You've really got class, Dresden, Susan said. Class oozes out of my every orifice, I agreed.
I passed her my staff and rod.
Hold these for me.
Seconds, please retire to your positions, said the archive.
Susan put her hand on my arm, fingers clenching tight for a second. I reached up and touched her hand. She let go and backed away to third base.
Thomas offered to high-five Ortega.
Ortega glared. Thomas smiled a Colgate smile and swaggered over to first base. He drew a silver flask of something from his hip pocket on the way and took a sip. The archive looked back and forth between me and Ortega. She was standing on the pitcher's mound next to the floating glob of chilling energy, so she was a shade taller than Ortega and a shade shorter than me. Her face was solemn, even grim. It didn't sit well on a child who should have been getting up for school in the morning.
Are you both resolved to this duel?
I am, Ortega said. Uh-huh, I nodded. The archive nodded.
Gentlemen, present your right hands, please.
Ortega lifted his right arm, palm faced toward me. I mirrored him. The archive gestured, and the Mordite sphere floated up until it hovered precisely halfway between Ortega and me. Tension gathered against my palm, an invisible and silent pressure. It felt vaguely like holding my hand against a recirculating outlet in a swimming pool. It was a tenuous thing that felt like it might easily slide to one side. If it did, I'd get to see the Mordite up close and personal. My heart skittered over a couple of beats, and I took a deep breath, trying to focus and ready myself. If I was Ortega, I'd want to open up with everything I had in the first heartbeat of the contest, and end it almost before it began. I took a couple of deep breaths and narrowed my focus, my thoughts, until the pressure against my hand and the deadly darkness a few feet away from it were all that existed.
Begin,
said the archive. She backed quickly toward home plate. Ortega let out a shout, a battle cry, his body dipping slightly, hips twisting, shoving his hand forward like a man trying to close a vault door with one arm. His will flooded toward me, wild and strong, and the pressure of it drove me back onto my heels. The Mordite sphere zipped across 3 of the 4 feet between it and me. Ortega's will was strong. Really, really strong. I tried to divert it, to overcome it and stop the sphere. For a panic second, I had nothing. The sphere kept drifting closer to me. 1 foot, 10 inches, 6 inches. Small tendrils of inky darkness drifted out from the cloud around the Mordite, reaching out blindly toward my fingers. I gritted my teeth, hardened my will, and stopped the thing 5 inches from my hand. I tried to mount up some momentum of my own, but Ortega held strong against me.
Don't draw this out, boy, Ortega said through clenched teeth. Your death will save lives. Even if you kill me, my vassals at Casa Verde are sworn to hunt you down. You and everyone you know and love.
The sphere came a bit closer.
You said you wouldn't harm them if I agreed to the duel, I growled. I lied, Ortega said. I came here to kill you and end this war. Anything else is immaterial. You bastard. Stop fighting it, Dresden. Make it painless for yourself. If you kill me, they will be executed. By surrendering, you preserve them. You're Miss Rodriguez, the policewoman. The investigator you apprenticed under. The owner of that bar. The knight and his family. The old man in the Ozarks. The wolf children at the university. All of them. I snarled. Buddy, you just said the wrong thing.
I let the anger Ortega's words had ignited flood down through my arm. A cloud of scarlet sparks erupted against the Mordite sphere, and it started creeping the other way. Ortega's face became strained, his breathing heavier. He didn't waste any effort on words now. His eyes darkened until they were entirely black and inhuman. There were ripples here and there under the surface of his skin, the flesh mask that contained the vaguely bat-like monster those of the Red Court really were. The monstrous Ortega, the true Ortega, stirred underneath the false human shell, and he was afraid. The sphere crept closer. Ortega renewed his efforts with another war cry, but the sphere made it to the midway point and got closer to him.
Fool,
Ortega said in a gasp.
Murderer,
I said, and shoved the sphere another foot closer to him. His jaw clenched harder, the muscles in his face bulging.
You'll destroy us all!
Starting with you, the sphere darted a little nearer.
You're a selfish, self-righteous madman! You murder and enslave children, I said.
I shoved the Mordite sphere to within a foot of him. You threaten the people I love, I shoved it closer still.
How does it feel, Ortega? Being too weak to protect yourself. How does it feel to know you are about to die?
In answer, a slow smile crept over his face. His shoulders moved a little, and I saw that one of his arms hung limply at his side, like an empty sleeve. A small bulge appeared just to one side of his stomach, like a gun being held in an overcoat pocket. I stared at it in shock. He'd pulled his real arm out of the flesh mask. He was holding a gun on me.
How does it feel? Ortega asked, voice very quiet. Why don't you tell me?
Chapter 30.
You can't,
I said. I shot a glance over to home plate, but the archive apparently hadn't noticed anything amiss. My will wavered, and the Mordite sphere bobbed back and forth.
They'll hear the shot. They'll kill you.
Quite possibly, he agreed. As I said, I am prepared to accept that.
His words chilled me, and the Mordite sphere darted at my head. I caught it a couple of feet from me and held it, but just barely.
I told you, Dresden, there's only one way this can end. I would have preferred an honorable demise for you, but any death will do.
I stared at the hidden gun. A dot of bright scarlet light appeared on Ortega's chest and tracked slowly up. My expression must have changed because Ortega glanced down too. The bright pinpoint of the laser sight settled over his heart and became still. Ortega's eyes widened and his expression twisted into fury. A lot of things happened at once. There was a hissing sound, a thump, and a big section of Ortega's chest dented in. Scarlet sprayed out behind him. An instant later, a booming sound much deeper than the crack of a rifle echoed around the stadium. Ortega let out a screech that went off the high end of the scale. Fire erupted from the hidden gun, burning through Ortega's flesh mask and shirt to reveal the muzzle of a small caliber revolver clenched in an inhuman black hand. The bullet Ortega had taken had half twisted him, and he missed. I thought hanging around to let him try again was a bad idea, so I threw myself to one side and gave the Mordite sphere another shove. Ortega dodged the Mordite, and even wounded, he was fast. A bright red dot appeared on his thigh for a half a second, and with another hiss, thump, boom, the unseen gunman hit him again. I heard the bones of Ortega's leg break. Susan threw my staff and rod to me and leapt for Ortega, grabbing his free arm and twisting as if to throw him. Instead, the vampire writhed weirdly, and she wound up tearing the flesh mask from him, peeling it away like a banana skin to reveal the slime, slick, flabby-bodied creature beneath it, the true Ortega. He still held the gun, though, and he turned to shoot at me again. I screamed,
Vinta Servitas!
At the top of my lungs, throwing my will at the dirt of the pitcher's mound, it whirled up into a miniature cyclone of fine brown soil, forcing the vampire to turn its head and shield its eyes. The second shot went wild as well, and I scrambled to get my blasting rod. The flying dirt slowed her down, but Susan still went for Ortega's gun hand. It was a mistake. Even with only one leg to support him, Ortega screeched again, twisted, and flung Susan from the pitcher's mound into the third row of seats behind first base. She hit with bone-breaking force and dropped out of sight. Sudden screeches filled the air, and I looked up to see as many as a dozen of the Red Court, revealed in their true forms, coming into the stadium. Some climbed over the walls, some jumped in from the upper levels, and some came bursting out of private boxes in showers of exploding glass. I spun toward Ortega, lifting my blasting rod, rammed my will through it, and shouted,
Fuego!
A jet of flame as thick as my arm roared at him. But one of the incoming vampires hit him at the shoulder, dragging him out of the line of fire. The newcomer was set alight, though, greasy skin going up like a bonfire, and it screamed hideously as it burned. I sensed movement behind me and turned to find Kincaid dashing across the ground. He scooped up the archive and raced for one of the dugouts. One of the Red Court vamps got in his way. Kincaid's arm blurred, a semi-automatic appearing in it, and without missing a step, he put two shots neatly between the vampire's eyes. The vampire started to fall, and as he went by it, Kincaid pumped another half-dozen shots into its belly, which erupted in a messy shower of scarlet and left the vampire screaming and thrashing weakly on the ground.
Harry! Look out!
Thomas screamed. I didn't look out. I figured on the worst and leapt forward. I heard a vampire hiss as it missed me, and it came rushing up behind me. I turned and unleashed another gout of fire from my blasting rod, but missed. The vampire closed on me, spraying venomous saliva into my face. I'd been hit with vampire venom before, and the stuff worked fast, particularly in large amounts. But I'd taken the potion to block it, and all this did was make me itch. I used the time while the vampire sprayed me to prepare another blast, and unleashed the strike with the rod pressed against the vamp's flabby body. It scorched a wound in the vampire's belly the size of my fist, and blew a 2-foot hole in the creature's back. The vampire went into weak spasms, and I kicked it off me, rising. 7 or 8 vampires were within 50 feet of me, and coming fast. Thomas sprinted toward me, a knife gleaming in his hand, and hit one of the vamps from behind. He cut open the vampire's belly with a single slice, and the creature collapsed to the ground.
Harry, get out!
No, I shouted. Get Susan out of here! Thomas gritted his teeth but changed course. He leapt up onto the first base dugout and hopped neatly over the rail into the stands. No help there, and there wasn't time to look for options. I crouched and concentrated, chanting, Defendre, Defendre, in a steady litany. It was difficult to do without my shield bracelet to focus it, but I brought up all the defensive energy I could manage in a dome around me. The vampires hit it, slamming against it in mindless, shrieking rage. Any one of them could have flipped my car over lengthwise with only a little effort. Their blows against the shield could have crushed concrete within seconds. And I knew I was not going to be able to hold the defense in place for long. Once it went down, they were going to literally tear me limb from limb. I gave the shield my all and felt them slowly breaking it down. Then there was a roar and a flash of brilliant light. A jet of fire streaked over me and took one of the vampires full on in the head. It burst into flame, screaming and waving its 2 thin arms, and went down onto the field, thrashing like a half-crushed bug. My shield collapsed, overloaded, and the bracelet began burning my wrist. I crouched lower. Another jet of fire went by, incinerating the head of another vampire. All of them stopped, crouching, shrieking in confusion.
Kincaid stood outside the dugout and dropped a smoking shotgun to the ground. He reached into a golf bag next to him, smooth and professional, and drew out another double-barreled shotgun. One of the vampires leapt at him, but Kincaid was too fast. He pulled the trigger and the shotgun roared. A jet of flame streaked out and went through the vampire, taking this one in the neck, and continuing to the right field fence where it blew a hole the size of my face in the wall. There was a sound behind him, and Kincaid spun to shoot the other barrel at a vampire bounding down through the stands above the third base dugout. He put the shot right down the vampire's throat, literally, and the creature went up in flames. Kincaid discarded that shotgun as well and reached for the stock of another in his golf bag. The other vampires leapt at Kincaid when he turned his back. They got to deal with the archive instead. The child stepped out from behind the golf bag, the tenebrous Mordite sphere floating between her hands. She released the sphere and made a single gesture. The little cloud of darkness blurred toward the vampires and streaked into each in turn at the pace of a busy workman's hammer. Bang, bang, bang. When the Mordite sphere struck them, there was a flash of cold purple light, a swell of darkness, and then the sphere passed on through. It left ash and black bones raining down behind it. I could barely follow the Mordite sphere's path. It moved so fast. 1 second the vampires were all there, and then they were simply gone. Black bones and gray ash littered the ground around me. Silence fell, and the only thing I could hear was my own ragged breathing and the roaring of my own pulse in my ears. I looked around wildly, but I didn't see Ortega anywhere. The two vampires, who had been gutted, writhed feebly on the ground. Kincaid drew the last shotgun from the golf bag, and with two more flaming blasts, executed them both. The Mordite sphere glided gently back to rest between the archive's tiny hands, and she stood regarding me for a long and silent moment. There was nothing in her expression, nothing in her eyes, nothing. I felt the beginnings of a soul gaze and pulled my face away, fast.
"Who broke the sanctity of the jewel first, Kincaid?"
asked the archive. "Couldn't tell," Kincaid answered. He wasn't so much as breathing hard. But Dresden was winning. The archive stood there a moment more and then said,
"Thank you for letting me pet your kitty, Mr. Dresden, and thank you for my name."
That sounded frighteningly like a goodbye, but it was only polite to answer. "You're welcome, Ivy." The archive nodded and said,
"Kincaid, the box, please."
I looked up to watch Kincaid set the wooden box down on the ground. The archive sent the Mordite sphere gliding slowly down into it and then closed the lid on the box.
"These proceedings are concluded."
I looked around at the bones, dust, and smoldering vampire corpses. "You think?" The archive regarded me with neutral eyes and said,
"Let's go. It's after my bedtime."
"I'm hungry," Kincaid said, shouldering his golf bag. "We'll hit a drive-through. You can have the cookies."
"Cookies aren't good for me,"
the archive said, but she smiled. Kincaid said, "Dresden, hand me that, will you?" I looked numbly at the ground where he pointed. One of the shotguns was there. Its barrels were still smoking hot. I picked it up gingerly by the stock and passed it to Kincaid, who wrapped it with the other gun he'd used in some kind of silver-lined blanket. "What the hell are those things?" I asked. "Incendiary rounds," he said. He passed my dropped staff over to me. "Work real well on the reds, but they're so hot they warp gun barrels. If you get unlucky, the second shot can blow back into your face, so you have to use throwaway guns." I nodded thanks and took my staff. "Where can I get some?" Kincaid grinned. "I know a guy. I'll have him call you. See you, Dresden." Kincaid and the archives started out of the stadium. A thought finally made its way through the combat adrenaline, and I broke into a sprint toward the first base dugout. Thomas had simply hopped up onto it. I managed to flop and clamber my way up, then into the stands. Thomas was already there, on the ground, with Susan. He'd taken off her jacket and used it to elevate her feet slightly. It looked as if he tilted her head back a little to clear the airway. He looked up and said, "She's unconscious, but she's alive." I crouched down too and touched her throat, just to be certain. "How bad is she hurt?" He shook his head.
No real way to tell. We have to get her to a hospital, then, I said, rising. Thomas caught my arm. You don't want her waking up injured and dazed in a place packed to the roof with weakened prey. Then what the hell do we do? Look, if she's not dead, odds are she'll recover. Thomas held up his hand and fished out a ballpoint pen from his pocket. He twisted it and said, clear. Then he twisted it again and put it back. A moment later, Martin came rapidly down the aisle. He somehow made even that look boring, as if he were simply a man wanting to take his seat again before the opening pitch. It was especially impressive since he carried a huge rifle, a military sniper weapon with a telescopic sight and a laser attachment. He set the rifle aside and went over Susan for a moment, feeling here and there, before he said, "She'll be sore." "You?" I asked. "You were the gunman?" "Obviously," Martin said. "Why do you think we were in Chicago to begin with?" "Susan said she was getting her things." He looked up at me skeptically. "You believed that? I would have thought you knew Susan well enough to know that material things don't hold a lot of interest for her." "I knew that," I said. "But she said..." I trailed off and shook my head. Martin looked up and said, "We knew Ortega was coming to kill you. We knew that if he succeeded, he might be able to bring the war to a peaceful conclusion, only to begin it again 20 years from now, from a much stronger position. I was sent to make sure Ortega did not kill you, and to eliminate him if I could."
"Did you?"
Martin shook his head.
"He had planned for the contingency. Two of his vassals got to him during the fight. They pulled him out. I don't know how badly he was hurt, but it's likely he'll make it back to Casa Verde."
"You want the war to keep going. You're hoping the White Council will destroy the Red Court for you." Martin nodded. "How did you find out about the duel?" Martin didn't answer. I narrowed my eyes and looked at Thomas. Thomas put on an innocent expression.
"Don't look at me. I'm a drunken, chemical-besotted playboy who does nothing but cavort, sleep, and feed. And even if I had the mind to take a bit of vengeance on the Red Court, I wouldn't have the backbone to actually stand up to anyone." He flashed me a radiant smile. "I'm totally harmless."
"I see," I said. I took a deep breath and regarded Susan's face quietly for a moment. Then I bent down, got into her pockets, and got the keys to the rental car.
"Are you leaving now, Martin?"
"Yes. I don't think our presence will be noticed here, but there's no sense in taking chances."
"Take care of her for me," I said.
Martin looked up at me for a second and then said, in a quiet voice, "Everything in my power. You have my word." I nodded. "Thank you." I stood up and started for the exits, drawing the coat to cover my gun.
"Where are you going?"
Thomas called.
"The airport," I answered. "I've got to meet some people about an old man and a bedsheet."
Chapter 31 I parked at a rental lot outside O'Hare about 5 minutes after 7. I got out of the car with my staff and rod in hand. There was only one old light burning on the lot, but the moon had risen huge and bright, and I had no trouble seeing Michael coming. His white truck came crunching to a halt on the gravel in front of me. I walked around to the passenger door. Sonia swung it open for me, then slid over. He was wearing blue denim and a big black cowboy hat.
"Harry," Michael said as I got in, "I was getting worried. You won?"
"Not exactly."
"You lost?"
"Not exactly. I had Ortega on the ropes and he cheated. Both of us cleared the benches. I came out of it in one piece. He came out in a couple of pieces, but he got away."
"Is Susan all right?"
"She got thrown about 25 yards through the air and hit steel and concrete. She'll be fine." Something tickled my nose and I sniffed. The sharp odor of metal filled the cab of the truck.
"Michael, are you wearing the armor?"
"I am wearing the armor," Michael said, "and the cloak."
"Hello, Michael. We're going to an airport, the kind with metal detectors."
"It's all right, Harry. Things will work out."
"Will it sound like alarms going off when they do?"
I glanced at the younger knight and said, "Sonia isn't wearing armor." Sonia half turned toward me and pulled his denim jacket open, revealing a Kevlar vest beneath it.
"I am," he said soberly.
15 layers with ceramic plating over critical areas.
Well, at least you don't look like a Renaissance festival, I said. This thing might actually protect you, besides making a slightly less medieval fashion statement.
Is this the new stuff or the old stuff?
New, Sonya said. We'll stop civilian munitions, even some military rounds.
But not knives or claws, Michael murmured. Or arrows.
Sonya buttoned his coat back up, frowning. Yours will not stop bullets, Michael said. My faith protects me.
I exchanged a skeptical look with Sonya and said,
Okie dokie, Michael. Do we have any idea where the bad guys are?
The airport, Michael said. I sat there silently for a second before I said,
Needle, haystack, where at the airport?
Michael shrugged, smiling, and opened his mouth to speak. I held up my hand.
We must have faith, I said, doing my best to imitate Michael's voice.
How did I guess? Did you bring Fidelakius?
In the tool locker, Michael said.
I nodded. Shira's going to need it back. Michael was quiet for a moment before he said,
Yes, of course.
We're going to save him.
I pray it is so, Harry.
We will, I said. I stared out the window as Michael pulled into the airport proper.
It's not too late.
O'Hare is huge. We drove around in crowded parking lots and auto-loading zones for nearly half an hour before Michael abruptly slowed the truck down outside the International Concourse, his spine and neck straightening as if he'd heard a warning klaxon. Sonya glanced aside at Michael and said,
What is it?
Do you feel that? Michael asked him.
Feel what?
Close your eyes, Michael said. Try to still your thoughts.
I muttered,
I sense a great disturbance in the force.
You do? Michael asked, blinking at me.
I sighed and rubbed at the bridge of my nose. Sonya closed his eyes, and a second later his expression twisted in distaste.
Rot, the Russian reported. Sour milk. Mildew. The air smells greasy.
There's a Pizza Hut kiosk about 50 feet away, I pointed out, looking through the windows of the concourse. But maybe it's just a coincidence.
No, Michael said. It's Nicodemus. He leaves a kind of stain everywhere he goes. Arrogance, ambition, disregard.
I only smell rotten things, Sonya said.
You're sensing him too, Michael said. Your mind is interpreting it differently. He's here.
He started pulling forward, but a cab zipped in front of him and stopped. The cabbie got out and began unloading an elderly couple's bags. I muttered to myself and sniffed. I even reached out with my magical senses, trying to detect what Michael had. I felt nothing but the usual, patternless white noise of thousands of lives moving around us. I opened my eyes and found myself staring at the back of Detective Rudolph's head. He had on the usual expensive suit and stood with a spare, well-coiffed man I recognized from the district attorney's office. I froze for a second. Then I snatched Sonya's black Stetson and pulled it down over my head. I tugged the brim down over my eyes and slouched down as low as I could.
What is it? Michael asked.
Police, I said.
I took a more careful look around. I spotted 7 uniformed officers and maybe 10 other men who wore suits and casual clothes but walked and stood like cops.
I passed word to them that the Shroud might be on the way out of Chicago through here.
Then why are you hiding?
A witness reported me leaving the scene of a murder. If someone identifies me, I'm going to spend the next day or so getting questioned, and that won't help Shiro.
Michael's brow knitted in concern.
True. Do the police know of the Denarians?
Probably not. SI isn't on the case. Probably they've been told they're some kind of terrorists and to be considered dangerous.
The cabbie in front of us finally finished up, and Michael pulled away from the loading zone and toward the parking lot.
That isn't good enough. We can't have them there.
As long as the police are around, it will restrict the Denarians' movements, make them keep their heads down and play nice.
Michael shook his head. Most supernatural creatures will hesitate before killing a mortal police officer, but Nicodemus won't. He has nothing but contempt for mortal authorities. If we confront him, he will kill anyone who attempts to stop him, as well as taking hostages to use against us.
Sonya nodded.
Not to mention that if this plague curse is as formidable as you say, it would be dangerous to those nearby.
It's worse than that, I said. Michael rolled the steering wheel toward a parking space.
How so?
Fort Hill told me that the Denarians get a power boost from hurting people, right? Causing mayhem and destruction?
Yes, Michael said.
The curse is only going to last a few days, but while it does, it's going to make the Black Death look like chicken pox. That's why he's here. It's one of the busiest international terminals on the planet.
Mother of God, Michael swore.
Sonya whistled.
Flights from here go directly to every major nation in the world. If the Denarian's plague is easily communicable...
I think I pretty well summed that up with the Black Death comment, Sonya. The Russian shrugged.
Sorry. What do we do?
We call in a bomb threat, clear out the people, and shut down the planes.
We need to be inside immediately, Sonya said. How long would it take the authorities to react?
It would only work if I knew who to call to get an immediate reaction.
Do you? Sonya asked.
I held my hand out to Michael. He slapped his cell phone into it. No, I said, but I know someone who does.
I called Murphy, trying to remain calm and hoping that the phone didn't explode against my head.
When I got the connection, it was cloudy with bursts of static, but I managed to tell her what was going on.
You're insane, Dresden, Murphy said. Do you know how incredibly irresponsible and illegal it is to falsify a bomb threat?
Yeah, less irresponsible than letting cops and civilians get in these people's way. Murphy was quiet for a second and then asked,
How dangerous are they?
Worse than the Lugaroo, I said.
I'll make the call.
Did you get in touch with him? I asked.
I think so, yes. Do you need any more muscle?
Got plenty, I said. What I'm short on is time. Please hurry.
Be careful, Harry.
I hung up the phone and got out of the truck. Michael and Sonya came with me. Murphy's going to report a bomb threat. The cops will clear everyone out of the building. That will clear out the area for us.
Leaving the Denarians without anyone to infect or take hostage, Sonya said.
That's the idea. After that, they'll call in the bomb squad and backup. We'll have 20 minutes, tops, to take advantage of the confusion.
Michael unlocked the tool locker in the back of the pickup and drew out Shiro's cane. He tied a strap to it and slung it over his shoulder. While he did, Sonya buckled Esperakius to his hip, then drew a freaking assault rifle out of the tool locker.
Kalashnikov, isn't it? I asked. That's an extremely Chuck Heston look for the Knights of the Cross.
Sonya slapped a magazine into the weapon, chambered around, and made sure the gun's safety was on.
I consider myself a progressive.
Too random for my taste, Michael said. Too easy to hurt the wrong person.
Maybe, Sonya said. But the only people inside should be the Denarians, yes?
And Shiro, I said.
I will not shoot Shiro, Sonya assured me.
Michael buckled Amorakius onto his hip.
How much longer will it take?
The buzzing ring of a fire alarm blared from the concourse, and the police got together. A grizzled detective in a bad suit took charge and started directing suits and uniforms around. People started hurrying out of the concourse.
Ask and ye shall receive, I said. Let's circle around. Get in through one of the service entrances.
Sonya slipped the assault rifle into an over-the-shoulder sports bag, but kept one hand on the stock. Michael nodded to me, and I took the lead. We circled around the building until we could see some of the planes. Ground crews were rushing around in confusion, and several guys with orange flashlights were waving them at flight crews, directing the wallowing jets away from the ramps to the concourse. We had to climb a fence and drop down a 10-foot retaining wall to get behind the concourse, but in the dark and the confusion, no one noticed us. I led us through a ground crew door and through a room that was part garage and part baggage storage. Emergency lights were on and fire alarms still jangled. I passed a section of wall covered with calendar pinup girls, pictures of trucks, and a map of the concourse.
Whoa, stop, I said.
Sonya bumped into my back. I glowered at him and then peered at the map.
Here, I said, pointing at a marked door. We'll come out on this stairway.
Midway through, Michael noted. Which way do we go?
Split up, Sonya suggested. Michael and I said, bad idea, at precisely the same time.
Think, I muttered, mostly to myself.
If I were an arrogant, psychotic, demon-collaborating terrorist out to trigger an apocalypse, where would I be?
Sonya leaned over to look at the map and said,
The chapel.
The chapel, said Michael. The chapel, I echoed. Down this hall, up the stairs and to the left. We ran down the hall and up the stairs. I pushed open the door and heard